Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and today I'm joined by Alex Stewart. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Oh, you know.
Everything's fine. We'll be joined by Seb shortly enough. He's delayed, but no worries. We've started without him because he's really not that important anyway. There's lots to discuss today. The Charity Shield occurred over the weekend, of course, which was fun. I was surprised by how much I missed football, even though it had been gone for 3 weeks, so we'll talk about that. Seb's put all sorts of strange things like Montpellier Marseille in here and Metz Lille, so, you know, maybe we'll get around to that. West Ham, a little bit about West Ham. Barcelona and Juventus, the danger of doing an intro at the beginning before we've actually done anything is we might not talk about any of those things. But two things we definitely will talk about, Alex: Messi and Lukaku. And do you know where the best place is to read about Messi and about Lukaku, Alex?
I have a feeling you're going to tell me, Joe.
It's The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you'll find that for this week only, you can get 50% off an annual subscription to The Athletic. And I believe that takes us back to the 8p a day times. Is that right? The point is, it's about the price of an expensive London cup of coffee for the entire month of exclusive access to some of the best football writers in the country. And I tell you what, they really come into their own around this time of year, don't they? It's lovely to read all of the interesting stuff, particularly about Messi and Lukaku, and we'll be talking about that today. There's your cue to nod or say something.
All right. Well, I'm very excited that Dan Sheldon and Adam Leventhal have reported the Adam Armstrong potentially to Southampton move. So,
yeah,
that's something for me to get stuck into.
What a way to get the masses happy and excited. Jubilant, you might say. Anyway, for now, I will leave you in the cold, dead arms and embrace of Seb Stafford-Bloor, who's not here because he's late. With Lionel Messi, because it was, jokes aside, actually, it was rather astonishing to watch yesterday. And I don't say astonishing, not, I mean, it's the wrong word, isn't it? Not surprising. It was something to watch his press conference, Alex, as he, was in tears, acknowledging leaving the club, I suppose, that he loves, that he's been at for a number of years, over a decade, of course, as everyone around him gave him a standing ovation, which lasted for many seconds.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of manufactured emotion in football, but it's very difficult to watch that press conference and not feel that Messi is genuinely sad about what's happened. Obviously, Barcelona fans are genuinely sad because they've lost somebody who is still arguably the greatest current player and probably the greatest ever. Mm. And it's not through Messi's fault, is it? I mean, the simple fact is that, as Dermot Corrigan has catalogued on The Athletic, that Barcelona are just a very badly run club at the moment. I found the Messi should play for free opinions slightly bizarre. I mean, not least because it's not actually lawful under Spanish employment law. But also...
Yeah, for good reason.
Why? You know, he's a valuable commodity. His labor is worth something. If the club can't get their ducks in a row sufficiently to sign him, why should he have to do that?
Yeah, it's not his fault that he can't play there anymore.
Absolutely not. No.
I found it very moving. And I thought also it seemed, obviously it was a moment of realization, and crucially in the moments before he breaks down a little bit, he says he doesn't have any more words. He doesn't know what else to say. He figured he'd open it up for questions. And it feels like when you look at the pace of his career, how much he's won, how successful he's been, even just how many goals he's scored, and how to maintain the level that he's at, I mean, at 34 years old, he mustn't have stopped ever. So it feels like kind of poignant in a sense. I know I'm over dramatizing it and romanticizing it a little bit, but the idea that he didn't have any more words and had to stop and there was a silence before there were any questions, it feels like a great poignant moment of reflection, you know? He's leaving this club now, but also maybe that's one of the first times he's been able to look back and think about actually what he's achieved.
I think that's very true, because I think, yes, obviously from an on-field perspective, he's been the talisman that club that is particularly associated with a particular period of domination as well under Guardiola as a manager, which Seb wrote very beautifully about on The Athletic. But Messi has been emblematic of that period, more so even than the kind of the homegrown players like Iniesta and Xavi. That's partially a longevity thing. It's partially an ability thing. And then also during the pandemic period, where Messi was sort of advocating for pay cuts and trying to ensure that the club was looking after its staff and that kind of thing, he took on a certain leadership role off the pitch as well. And I can't really think, I mean, maybe Cruyff for Ajax, but I can't think of a player who has come to stand so emphatically for their club over such a long period of time and done on and off the pitch so much for them.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it's easier to think of examples for national teams maybe, but not for club teams. It's hard. Maybe Totti.
Yeah, no, that's true. But also with a fraction of the success that those other two players had.
Sure.
And I think you're right. In order to maintain those personal levels of success, but also to be the catalyst for the team to be able to continue achieving that sort of thing, it places an enormous burden on somebody.
Okay, well, the expectation is that Messi will sign for PSG. I mean, he's made it, we've made it clear during the press conference that he hasn't agreed anything and lots of clubs are interested, but all of the reports appear to point towards that being a reality. And it's possible by the time people are listening to this that that has become a reality. The thought of that team with Mbappe and Neymar and Messi and Di Maria and Verratti and also all the other players too. The thought of that team is rather frightening, isn't it? Just have a go at that.
It is frightening. I mean, I think as well that the capacity that team will have under Pochettino as a coach, the amount of talent that they have in depth, particularly in the attacking positions, but also obviously they've signed Sergio Ramos, who brings experience and leadership as well. It's very difficult to look past them, certainly as very, very serious Champions League contenders.
Yeah.
But also, I think it'll be interesting to see if they're fun, because there is a possibility maybe that you end up getting that alchemy slightly wrong and they're not as attacking as they want to be, or the team is unbalanced. I think the idea that Pochettino has
gone from a place where he was desperate for stars and had Harry Kane, obviously, to a place where he's got too many.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem with these sorts of teams. There always has to be a balance, and you go back to someone like Claude Makélélé's job at Real Madrid, you know, whether it's Idrissa Gueye that does that there will have to be somebody that knits that team together in terms of how it plays. And it will be interesting to see how Pochettino manages that.
Seb sent us a text message to say that there's a noise that he can't stop. And I think he must be referring to his internal monologue, which I'm sure is berating him for being such a bad person, you know. But I wish he was here to answer a question about what he thinks Messi will be like at PSG, you know?
I have arrived. The monologue has been silenced.
Oh, it's weird. I can hear his internal monologue, and it is. It makes me so upset. It's horrible. I don't like it. I really want to crumple away into a ball of nothingness. Hi, Seb. What was the noise you couldn't stop? Was it your internal monologue?
No. So I have recently moved into a new house, and from time to time, there are things that go on in the house that make lots and lots of noise, and I did not have a good enough command of German to make them stop. And it makes me really angry.
Don't you shout, Scheiße, out the window over and over again until they stop.
No, I tried that and no one was very responsive. It just came across like I was having some kind of minor breakdown.
So, Seb, tell me what you think about Messi at PSG. In fact, you missed a bit at the beginning where we were talking about his press conference. I thought maybe you'd like to speak about that because it was very moving. We said it was moving.
I found it, Joe, in equal parts moving and a little bit strange. Because very unusual, isn't it? When in the past, have you ever had a situation where a player in a club, despite reaching an agreement, despite making concessions to one another, have been prized apart? And I suppose it was kind of the perfect metaphor for modern football, in inverted commas, because it's not really about football at all, is it? And there have been so many things like this lately, big transfer fees, a small collection of clubs only able to afford to buy the very best players, also so much dysfunction that you can become a little bit hardened and fatigued towards it. it was unusual. It almost felt voyeuristic, actually, because it felt like you were intruding upon something that you had no business seeing. It was very, very strange.
Do you know how I see history? I see special moments as, this will be in lots of documentaries. Do you know what I mean? Almost as if I'm not in the moment, but I'm looking back on it from 30 years in the future. But it had that feeling, didn't it? It had an historic feeling attached.
It's, you know, in Premier League years on Sky, when you break from the action to have little current affairs snippets over the kind of, you know, in the background to left field playing over the top of it. This will be one of those, and you'll get a Sky Sports News reporter talking about it and saying, oh, yes, and, you know, in August, Lionel Messi said a tearful goodbye to Barcelona. And you'll just see Messi and some subtitles and him crying and Gerard Piqué looking sad. And, yeah, it all being very historical, as you said correctly.
Are you excited to see him at PSG, if indeed he does go there?
Do not care, could not possibly care less.
Nothing in you that is excited to see Neymar, Mbappe and Messi together. There's not even a tiny iota of your silly being that is a little bit excited about the prospect of that front three.
I've really tried with PSG.
You're dead inside.
I've really, really tried to suspend the reality and just enjoy Mbappe for who he is and Neymar. And to be honest, Mbappe I can just about, because he's a bit more new and I feel like I'm still learning about him as a player. With Neymar, not so much. With Messi, I've already seen the very best moments of his career. I love watching him, but I feel as if whatever happens from this point onwards has been denied a context which was important, attention that was important before. And I don't have that now. I don't have, for instance, yes, you could say that Barcelona during their very, very best years were no match for Sevilla and Atletico Madrid and, you know, Valencia. They routinely bullied these teams. But you always had a Clásico on the horizon. You always had something in the calendar which was a yardstick, which you'd have a sort of a building up towards moment. And PSG's four Champions League games that matter a season, they don't do it for me. I just don't care enough. And that's, you know, not coming with a deeper meaning. I just can't make myself believe in it or make it feel like it matters.
Alex, as a man who only really cares about patterns and lines, you must be a bit excited about the possible lines and patterns that you might see.
I think so. I mean, like I said, it'll be interesting to see how Pochettino crafts this team into something. And to what degree the pragmatism of having to rotate and balance the competing egos and stuff has an impact on the tactics. I mean, football tactics generally is not evolving an enormous amount anyway. So I don't think we're going to see some sort of massive change because they now have the ability to do something with this front three that no one else can do. It's, you know. But I think also, like Seb, it becomes difficult to divorce even that stuff from the context, and the context is increasingly dispiriting. So let's hope for some good lines.
Great, great. Well, speaking of lines and thrusting lines, Romelu Lukaku, great off the ball, and of course, off the pitch. We're hearing all sorts of things about how he might be probably going back to Chelsea. So I thought we'd talk about that as well, because it's an exciting prospect. I think it makes Chelsea seem like an extraordinarily good team ahead of next season. Also, it's a little odd that he's going back. I suppose some of the context around the transfer, Seb, relates to Inter Milan's need to sell. What do you make of this one?
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I'm a bit 50-50 on it because obviously, like you say, financially, there's an obvious reason for it. Inter have no money. Inter need money. Lukaku's probably their most saleable asset at the moment, so that makes sense. Mm. On the other hand, I'm always a little bit wary when a player has found a decent home somewhere where for Lukaku, it seems like there's this perfect confluence of factors. He is a very good team with players who suit him. He is also the main man in that team, really. I would place him above players like Barella and Martinez and Skriniar. Like he's the kind of the figurehead.
According to everything I've read, he was happy to stay, too. It wasn't like he was pushing for a move.
No, and that seems to tally with what we've heard. I don't think there's been any agitation. Like previously with Lukaku, he's whenever he's gone off and he's unhappy during his club career, whenever he's gone off on international duty, he's spoken to a journalist and, you know, he's put a line in a paper which suggests that a move isn't too far away. That hasn't happened here, and I understand why, because he has a perfect situation. I think this is probably the first time in his career where everybody has universally said, goodness, what a good player he is. There aren't the asterisks and caveats. People aren't boring on about his first touch, that kind of stuff. And now he's leaving that behind, returning to Chelsea, where potentially returning to Chelsea, where I understand he has unfinished business. He was never really given an opportunity there. And yet he puts himself back into the middle of a really tedious debate, because English football has always had a slightly different relationship with Lukaku to the one the Italian football has. Mm-hmm. So I fear for him a little bit. I think he'll be very successful, just because I think that Chelsea team is set up to benefit him, as long as they don't try and play him as a target man, which has been the kind of the problem in the past. But I can't see.
I don't think Tuchel will do that. No. Also, you have to think, like, Alex, Timo Werner and Romelu Lukaku playing together, two players who are very, very good at making runs. And they're generally speaking, they're great without the ball, right? And with it, of course. That's terrifying for any team that they play against, right?
Well, it gives them this enormous benefit, because Werner has a tendency to drift out into the left side of the pitch. Lukaku excels, particularly playing for Belgium, going the other way. And that will open up space for someone, for example, like Havertz, or potentially Mason Mount pushing up from the sort of eight position. So it allows Chelsea to have this sort of shifting emphasis with their attacking patterns in the wide areas. And I can see that as a partnership working really well. Also, Werner, previously when he's played well, he has played alongside or slightly off a more physically competitive striker. Mm-hmm. So I think that will be of benefit to him. I mean, I'm not saying that Yusuf Poulsen and Lukaku are similar players, but there will be
They're both stronger than Timo Werner.
Sure. defenders will be occupied with Lukaku's presence in a way that should allow not just Werner, I think also Havertz will be a real beneficiary of this. And, you know, Chelsea already were well set to be the challenger this coming season, I would say. I mean, in Tuchel, they have an exceptional manager, somebody who really refined his approach over the course of that season, bedded in very, very quickly, got players doing what he wanted them to do. And we saw how players like Rudiger or Christensen, Kovacic really kind of stepped up again under Tuchel. You add a striker of Lukaku's proven quality to that mix, which maybe was the one area that they were lacking, mm-hmm. all of a sudden they seem extremely dangerous.
Yeah, no, I can see that. That's very interesting. I mean, I was thinking generally about the Premier League in terms of who's challenging this year. I mean, don't even know who the favourite is. You would have thought, I guess it's Manchester City, but lots of teams have strengthened in a way that they just didn't last season, right? I mean, even Manchester United with Jadon Sancho.
I think United are, I mean, not a dark horse. That's a stupid thing to say, because...
to the dark horse chat.
They've got lots of money and they finish well. But I think Solskjaer is kind of batting off some of these issues now around his coaching. Players do seem to be developing well under him. They've got, you know, in adding... Like, I'm not as hot on Varane as some people are, but Sancho undoubtedly is an enormous talent. I still think they're a defensive midfielder light, like everybody else does. But so they're absolutely in the mix. City, again, I think City have issues unless they do sign Harry Kane. They look light up front. I mean, they didn't. I think their highest number of shots in the Charity Shield was Gundogan. Again, you can't keep relying on a midfielder bursting forwards to create all of your goals. So unless they do get a legit striker coming in, I'm not as keen on City. And then obviously you've got Liverpool there. It's very difficult.
Well, one other thing to say too, that we didn't mention earlier when we were talking about Messi, but a knock on of that is we read the reports beforehand that PSG were interested in signing Paul Pogba. And that obviously could not happen if the Messi deal goes through. So that kind of throws Paul Pogba's future into flux a little bit too, which I guess means he'll be staying at Man United, Seb.
Yeah, which to me, Joe, seems like a very miserable year for everyone involved. Because I think Manchester United, certainly from the reporting we've seen and read, Manchester United have kind of moved on emotionally from Paul Pogba and accepted the fact that he's probably likely to leave either this summer or next year. And for Pogba, it doesn't feel... Well, let's put it this way. The things that his agent has said suggest that he's not really invested with in the project. And, you know, I'm sure he'll sort of remain committed in the kind of the year-to-year sense, but he's not there for long term. So...
Yeah. Yeah, because to his credit, he did do that. I mean, it looked a lot like he was going to leave last summer. He obviously had injuries in the season, but he was one of United's best players last season when he was there and looked 100% committed to playing every game.
Yeah, I always think that actually with Pogba, part of the problem is the conversation, is that you have this really, it's not a million miles away from what we were referring to with Lukaku actually, in that there's always a discussion, and always a discussion in terms which don't seem to apply to other players. I think in this situation, if you're Manchester United, like last year, you probably felt, right, if we can make several steps forward, perhaps win the Europa League and show that we're a decent contender, or we're within touching distance of Manchester City or Liverpool. I know what happened to Liverpool, but even so, then perhaps you have a kind of a re-engagement. And I think Pogba, like you say, was engaged in what they were trying to do last season. Mm-hmm. It just felt very strange, the kind of the communication from Mino Raiola even. And yeah. I don't know. I don't see how Pogba with fans back. I suspect a section of them that Man United support will be quite hostile towards him. I don't think Pogba would deal particularly well with that, as most of us wouldn't. It just doesn't seem great for anybody. And
I don't know. There's been a section of the support which has been pretty hostile to Paul Pogba for some time, and he's always dealt
for sure
well with it.
I suppose it's different though, Joe. If you're in a situation where you think, right, well, I've got 3 years at this club, then perhaps you're inclined to be a little bit more thick-skinned towards that kind of thing. If you know that in 12 months' time you're going somewhere else, maybe less so. Because what's it worth to you?
Like, I know what you mean, but I don't see any... I'm going to be the Pogba fan club defender here, but I don't see any indication that that's his type of character. I know. I understand how that might happen to a person, but I don't think that happens to Paul Pogba.
I mean, what happens though, for instance, if... I don't know, between now and the end of the month, Manchester United do sign the central midfield, or they think, right, it's time to try and get more of a tune out of Donny van der Beek. What happens if he becomes, sure, through no fault of his own...
Donny van der bulked up.
Donny van der bulked up. He does look about 3 stone heavier, doesn't he?
He's bulked up over the summer, yeah.
Has he beat our side, or did someone just lock him in the weight room the entire summer?
Gym.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if Solskjaer thinks, right, I am working now in a three-year cycle, and... Paul Pogba, just on the basis of his contract, not because of his application or attitude or anything like that, if he's not going to be here for that period of time, then you're going to privilege and prioritise other players, because that's what you should do. To be honest, if Paul Pogba spends the next 12 months of his Man United career, final 12 months of his Man United career, giving brilliant performances, hats off to him. But I think most players under those circumstances would struggle. I don't think it's about... his world-class status or the type of player he is or anything like that. I just think it's the reality of it. We've seen this so many times before in football.
I think he'll be Manchester United's player of the year.
Big shout. Okay.
That's my pre-season before the season prediction. There we go.
Oh, well, let me ask you this then. If you think he's going to be the player of the year, do you think there will be a major effort to extend his deal? Or do you think that
I think it will probably extend before the this current transfer window ends.
Interesting. Okay.
I don't think he'll leave on a free next year.
It's strange because a couple of years ago, Arsene Wenger said that this will be the trend. He said that increasingly what you'll find is at least your sort of elite layer of footballers will start signing much shorter deals and getting to the end of their contracts and then either extending or going for the massive contracts. The sort of the killing, what it looks like.
He predicted what happened at Spurs, right?
Well, no.
It happened with Ericsson, it happened with Alderweireld, it happened, like, they all started to run their contracts down, right?
I'm not sure I'd put those players in that category. Like, I think of it as the kind of the Mbappe level. And all due respect to Ericsson and Alderweireld, brilliant players, absolutely at their best, but they're not at that level.
Sure, you mean elite players only?
I would put, yeah, the top 10 players in the world at any one time. That's the kind of the company I'm thinking of. And it just seems a very smart move if you're a player, particularly if, for instance, if you're looking at the Harry Kane situation, you're thinking never again is someone signing a six-year deal at a club where you're not necessarily guaranteed Champions League football every year. It's ridiculous.
Never. Also, if anyone's looking at the Messi situation, if he does sign for PSG for what the reported figures are, he earns a 25 million euro signing on fee, which ordinarily, I suppose, would have gone to a club. Do you know?
Yeah.
So there's a bit of extra cash involved in doing it that way too, I suppose, if you can hold out. Anyway, let's go to a break now, and we'll be back after the break. We're back! And it's time to discuss Leicester City 1, nil Manchester City. This was, of course, the Charity Shield, Alex, and that happens every summer. The winners of the FA Cup versus the Premier League. One of the most glorious titles of all time. Love it. Normally, I don't watch it because I can't be bothered with football at that point in the season. But weirdly enough, this weekend, I did watch it and I thought, oh, I'm excited. And boy, was I happy about what happened, because it was a good... What I'm saying is, it was a good game.
Yeah, it was an all right game.
It was fine.
I mean, it's in that weird kind of liminal space where it's sort of a competitive fixture and sort of still a preseason friendly. So
yeah,
you know,
there's something on the line.
There's more for Leicester,
maybe. You know,
yeah, I think Leicester are a fascinating club this season. They've built very astutely on what they achieved under Ranieri. Their transfer work is exemplary, arguably maybe second only to Brighton's in terms of finding, I don't want to say undervalued players, but looking a little bit deeper into the transfer market and coming up with players that maybe are worthy of a Premier League move but are written off for various other reasons. I think stuff like the signing of Patson Daka shows a long-term planning that's very sensible, obviously, as a sort of Jamie Vardy style replacement, and they are the club that are most likely to bridge that gap into the sort of the elite status, the big six, yeah, or whatever you call it.
Get up in there.
Well, yes, and they thoroughly deserve to be. And so in that regard, I guess, you know, the Charity Shield is a kind of an opportunity for them to show that they can compete in that status with those sorts of clubs. But it is still slightly slower, and there were players playing for Manchester City who you're not going to see week in, week out.
Yeah, tell me about those kids. One of them was called Palmer, I remember. There was another one. The other one was good too. What were they like? Were they good? Who are they?
I wasn't enormously impressed.
Watch your words when you ask Alex a question he hasn't prepared for. Tell me all about one of those young players I'd never seen before, Alex.
Tell me about Adosie was the other one. Samuel Adosie and Cole Palmer. Thank God for the internet.
Who was the boy that came on? He looked like he should have been in the In-Betweeners with his haircut. He's all spiky. Who was that?
Ben Knight.
Yes.
Yeah, I've now got the team sheet up, so I can just get like, well done. What I'm talking about.
Easy job.
I mean, yes, it was. I don't know though that Palmer was playing very, very high on that inside right position, so it was. I think that actually asked a lot of Cancelo. I'm not sure that tactically that was the most sensible move to try and do that. I guess they're compensating for the lack of thrust playing with an actual centre forward. I don't know. City looked a bit disjointed to me, whereas Leicester seemed tactically to know exactly what they were trying to do. There were very repeated patterns of play. Very, very good spacing between the two central midfielders. Nice.
Oh, we saw Patson Daka too.
We did see Patson Daka, yeah. Mm. It's good to see Harvey Barnes back as well.
Yeah.
After that injury, I like the way that Leicester were, you know, they kept him wide on the left-hand side and they pushed Pereira up on the right-hand side to get this kind of slightly asymmetrical effect that created a lot of space for Barnes.
And patterns and lines.
Yeah, he's somebody who was, you know, kind of again in that very congested England left attacking midfield space. Barnes was in the conversation before his injury, so it's good to see him back.
Yeah,
yeah,
I liked it. I was excited.
It was a fine game.
It felt like a fine game. Mm.
It was. I think the only thing that I really noticed was the the step up in pace from international football. It felt like the pitch was so much more crowded, yeah, and there was so much less time on the ball than we saw during the Euro.
Even in a friendly.
It's a friendly.
100% a friendly, yes.
Sure, okay.
It's nothing but a friendly. Fine, let's talk about other things, unless you were desperate to say something about the Charity Shield, Seb.
No, I really enjoyed it. It was so nice to have, friendly aside, really nice to have competitive club football back with fans. It was great.
Oh, sure, and they were competing for sure. I don't mean that they were friendly to each other. You're absolutely right.
No, but as Alex said, the pace of it was good. And yeah. I like international football, but I love club football. It was full of those kind of things. And I thought Leicester played really well. And it was great. And I really enjoyed seeing Pat Sandaka and Boubacar Samari's... there was a passage of play which lasted about 15 seconds where he seemed to dispossess about seven players just in the one motion. It was incredible.
Yeah.
It was like a threshing machine.
Yeah, Nacho as well, kicking off the season with a goal, another goal. Maybe he'll have another stellar season.
It's nice to see him do well because he had that awful moment against Manchester City a few years ago when he was in on goal and he missed, basically. Do you remember right on the edge of the penalty box at the Etihad?
No.
Pretty ugly moment for a player when you go back to your old club and you miss a sitter like that. And, you know, if he'd scored, it was a game where Vincent Kompany scored that 30-yarder and he had that chance to equalise, which probably would have given the title to Liverpool. And he got sort of vilified for that bit. So nice moment and wasn't really, he had a bit of a dropping off when he left Man City. So it was really nice to see that kind of his revival continue. And against City at Wembley, lovely.
Speaking of nice, Montpellier lost to Marseille, who scored three, Seb.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite games of the weekend. It was really strange because I went into the game and expecting Marseille to just be very, very entertaining. Sampaoli, obviously, is a bit... his football is bold and it's aggressive and it's interesting. And it was all of those things for 25 minutes. Marseille just couldn't find the final ball and, you know, put themselves one up. And then they fell two behind to one fluke and one ridiculous goal from Laborde where I still don't know whether he was crossing the ball, but it's one of those where it just curled in perfectly and kind of kissed the post just under the crossbar, went in. Mm. Marseille's comeback was great fun, not least because, and I know I'm repeating myself, but when they equalised, when Dimitri Payet scored his free kick, which... Hang your head in shame if you're in that Montpellier wall. That was disgraceful. That was just, if you find it, because it was very Sami Nasri-ish, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It wasn't the bravest moment for some of those players. Anyway,
Sami Nasri just comes to represent the cowardice.
Yeah. This is it. This is who he is. This is his place in the game.
There we go.
An internal reference point to describe terrible things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, equaliser went in and all the Marseille players went kind of rushing to the perimeter fencing where their fans were. It was a great moment. And then Payet scored a beautifully Dimitri Payet goal. Just quick feet, aggressive. And from the moment he picks it up, probably 25 yards out at an angle, you see him kind of gathering pace towards the penalty box. And what's about to happen is absolutely inevitable. And it was great. And it was just a lovely way to finish a weekend. Like when a weekend's football comes to a close on a Sunday night, instead of going, you know, watching some, you know, terrible like 1-1, 0-0 nonsense from somewhere, a proper 3-2 comeback, dramatic ending. It was great fun. I had a great, great day of Ligue 1 football as well.
I want to put something to you now. I read and enjoyed your piece on Lionel Messi that you wrote for The Athletic over the weekend. And one of your sort of clinching arguments in that was that you thought there was no better way to finish a football weekend than turning on La Liga to watch Messi play for Barcelona. It seems now that you're also saying that about Liga with some French teams. And of course, Messi may well move to PSG. So I put to you that your entire argument was BS, sir, and that you'll be just as happy to turn on the French football and watch Lionel Messi there. I've got you.
I think what
it's
I
a
need
gotcha
from
moment.
French football is equally matched teams. So Montpellier, Marseille is interesting because Marseille are fragile and you never quite know what they're going to be. Lille interesting because they won the title despite not being overwhelmingly outstanding. They are a very good team, but they're not littered with overpowering individuals.
Yeah.
Would I have tuned in last night to watch Montpellier against PSG? I just don't care.
Sure.
Also, I think what the article sort of, or the point depends on is Messi being in the right place, if that makes sense. He's a homegrown Barcelona product. He's a kind of the realization of everything.
I was just trying to gotcha. It doesn't matter.
I know, but I'm gotcha-ing you back. No.
Like, you can stop. Someone tell me about West Ham, because that's interesting. Alex, have you read this?
Yeah, I did. I did read it.
What do you think about it? Tell me what it is, because I haven't read it. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
Okay, well, I mean, so Matt Slater's written a great piece on The Athletic, which is going to give you far more detail than I can. But essentially, the summary is there are people looking to buy West Ham. The main guy is the son of an Azerbaijani oil and gas magnate of some description.
Wow,
and the son came up through Gazprom. There are questions over just how much capital is actually available for this. yes, as ever. And there's a bit of a back and forth over the valuation. So they've offered 400 million. David Gold's said no, but they're saying, well, that's what you said you wanted. So we're a bit confused. I think most interestingly is the presence of a guy in the bid whose name I've completely forgotten. But was also at QPR in a kind of footballing operations perspective. And he was involved in the Olympic legacy of 2012 and the stadium development there. So
you mean he made Boris Johnson the Prime Minister? Are we talking about Dominic Cummings? Is that the isn't that the legacy of 2012?
Politics is not my purview, but this is... It all points towards the fact that the London Stadium is this potentially incredibly lucrative asset in terms of property development. There are apartments around there. There are certain of the sporting venues that are still being used a lot. I have actually, in fact, been to the basketball one, which is quite interesting. But there's not a lot in terms of entertainment around there. Obviously, the stadium itself is used for gigs sometimes, but... it feels like there's a lot more that can be done there. And so if somebody is seeking to acquire West Ham, a lot of that acquisition is, I suspect, with that in the back of their mind. You know, how can we Stamford Bridgeify this area effectively and turn it into this kind of bustling cultural economic centre in this part of London? So
Yeah,
I mean, entirely divorced from football, but then as Seb would doubtless agree, so much of football does seem to be divorced from football. So
former QPR chief executive Philip Beard, off the top of my head.
Yes.
It's a really interesting anecdote about him. So when he was at QPR and he kind of had the patronage of Tony Fernandez when he was there, he resigned, I think I'm right in saying, he resigned after Les Ferdinand was promoted to director of football. Very strange moment. Les Ferdinand was promoted, and that seemed like a good thing, given his sort of roots at the club. And Philip Beard released a statement talking about how he'd been marginalised by it, or it was odd. It was a very strange way to end his time there, because he was managing director, and then you wouldn't have thought then that sporting director, managing director would have had too much overlap, other than in kind of transfer negotiations financially. But obviously, he felt differently, and that's how he left QPR, which is odd. And he's knocking about this West Ham takeover, apparently. I don't think they sell, just because I would have. It would surprise me if, having reached this point with West Ham, where the current ownership still not wildly loved by the fans, but they're hated less.
Sure,
it just seems like an odd time to sell. Like you're slightly on the up. You finally seem to have stumbled upon something that works. Good transfer activity over the summer, good, you know, reinforcements for the defence. We think Milenkovic is coming in there from Fiorentina at some point, we think, apparently. And why sell now? Also, the reported price is £400 million, which seems cheap to me. Interesting.
I'm really hungry, so I'm going to go now, because I think that's it, probably. It's been a nice time, though, hasn't it? The podcast's been fun for you, Alex.
fine.
Yeah, relatively so. And it's been fun for you, Seb?
I had a really nice time.
Great.
I'm really excited about the football season. Really excited.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm just showing how much more enthusiastic you are than me and make me feel bad.
I don't think I need the podcast to do that.
Probably nothing, actually.
Well, listeners and viewers, of course, because we are now releasing these videos filmed. I say filmed movie style on the TIFO IRL YouTube channel. Come and join us there, and please throw us a subscribe. We'd very much appreciate that. Thanks, of course, to Seb Stafford-Blore and Alex Stewart. JJ Bull will be back next week with us. And, of course, thanks, as always, to producer Adonis and film man Don Maher. So there we go. That's the end. Be back next Tuesday with more. And, of course, the Premier League will have started by then. Oh, and I'm on holiday, so I won't be here for another 3 weeks. But I'm sure you'll all have a lovely time. Ta-ra now.
The Athletic.